Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. It's because all you guys are Windows users, right?
Michelatus is GarageBand.
Okay. But is he the one that does the...
He goes straight into GarageBand. We use Audacity, me and JR.
Who actually edits the show?
Someone who came along and offered to help our train wreck of an audio setup. I don't know if you met JR. We just jumped right into podcasting, had no idea what you were doing.
No, dude, we did the same thing. That's what I was going to talk to you about, because listening to you guys... I found out that you're a huge Steelers fan.
I am I've been in Pittsburgh all my life. Currently, I'm like 10 minutes from the stadium. I live here.
Nice.
We're so jealous.
So you're Steelers fans?
Yes.
Super cool. Yeah, JR is also a Steelers fan, even though he lives in Dayton, Ohio.
Oh, that's probably dangerous for him.
I don't know. There's a lot of Steelers fans. You know, Cleveland, they've just given up. They're too embarrassed to be bold. Cincinnati's had a lot of – that's really dangerous for him this year, because since he went so far and he was right in the heart of those Bengals lovers.
When you say so far, you mean embarrassed in the playoffs, right?
Yeah, they did Cincinnati good.
Yeah, gosh. That was my friend who lives up near JR. He always posts like Steelers suck, you know, Bengals. And he doesn't even like football. He just does it because he's got so many Steelers fans.
Trolling.
Friends. Yeah. Which I tell him does not reflect well because he's a pastor. I'm like, you shouldn't be trolling people on the internet if you're a pastor.
When pastors troll.
So, but I'm glad you agreed to be on. I know we haven't actually technically met or anything, but.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You know, with the nature of internet and mediated communication, I constantly forget, like, when I've met people in real life or not, or like. Yeah, you know, here we are jumping on for the first conversation. I'm just like, yeah, hold on, I got to check my settings. you just get so comfortable through communication. It's not in person. So this is Mikey and Laura.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Now, when you had JR on, there was someone else on. There was another guy on that day, right?
Yes.
Who's that?
Okay, that was Griffin.
And he's not a regular?
Well, he is, but. The only person who is on every single episode of my podcast is me.
Okay.
And so to kind of try to keep it mixed up and, you know, well, the fact that I don't just talk about like nerd movies or dramas or cartoons or whatever. So I tend to have people who have specialized loves of a specific thing.
Yeah.
So when I wanted to get you on and I was like, oh, he's a history professor. Then I was like, Monuments Men.
Yeah, let's talk about the most disappointing history movie of the year.
The real question is it worse than Pearl Harbor?
Yes.
Wow.
No, wait. No.
We got to save that. That's juicy.
Well, and that's part of the thing about the episode. Like, I think there's one or two big questions to address.
Okay.
In this, and then I really didn't have a whole lot else.
Well, you're right on the money. There's plenty we can talk about with the film, good or bad, and more bad probably. But it does bring up a great conversation about the meaning of art, the importance of art. Mm-hmm. And we're all Renaissance men here in the podcasting world, so just go after any topic you want.
Okay. Well, there's nothing in particular that I wanted to prep you with. Like, if you saw the stuff I put out, then we should be good.
Mm-hmm.
Laura's been furiously... just researching all day.
Sure. Let's go with that.
Well, we had it was like one of those times that I felt like I was in a movie because the line was just so great. She was like, I'm so intimidated about being on the podcast tomorrow. I was like, why? She's like, you're putting me on a war movie history podcast with a history professor. And I was like, and a history major.
The context being that when I was student teaching, I was a high school teacher for a while.
Cool.
And I I have myself recorded saying to my students, the French and Indian War, I think that's when the French were fighting the Indians.
Yep. And then she came home and told me.
And, yep.
And the as soon as she said it out loud, the my bachelor's degree just caught on fire.
Yeah, she outed herself there.
Oh.
You know, I started teaching after, 7 years of college. You know, I'm like teaching my first ever college course. And it was like a race to stay 1 hour ahead of the students. That's the game. Yeah. I was learning stuff and walking in there like I'd been going over it for 20 years.
I've been listening to Storyman podcasts, and I just heard one where you talked about how in your beginning classes you would say things like, oh, yeah, students ask me that all the time.
Yeah. If I didn't know the answer to a question on my first month of teaching ever. Oh, that's a good question. That one comes up all the time.
All the time.
Like, I'm not even going to answer that one. It's so obvious.
Yeah, I did that because I was 21
yeah.
when I was teaching high school seniors. So.
When you were actually teaching, mm-hmm. you were student teaching, and you had students that
were
older than you.
I was 20, and I was student teaching.
Oh, homeschooling.
I didn't talk about this in the podcast. The first class I ever actually taught was History of Cold War at my alma mater. It was a summer course, and in the room, first of all, was a Vietnam vet. Also was a girl I'd been set up on a blind date with, and a guy who I'd been in, let's just say, a compromising situation with in Washington, D.C. like a month earlier. And I'm looking out, and I couldn't even like face them when they said, this is, you know, Professor Morgan. I was like, ah, this is so bad.
Oh my gosh. Well, maybe with that.
Let's do it.
How about I get us started? Is that okay?
I'm ready.
You good, Laura?
I guess so. This echo was really bad.
Yeah. Well, sound things. We can either.
You can't turn us down at all?
Not really.
Is it me that I'm too loud?
No. We're echoing.
Yeah. We have to hear our own voice.
Because you can't put headphones in?
No, we have headphones. It's complicated.
Okay, sorry.
This is what I was working on for like the last hour. It's just something we're not used to.
Neither of those.
But with that said, you ready?
You ready.
All right. Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 20. I'm your host, Fizz. On this episode of the podcast, we take a look at the Monuments Men, a George Clooney joint. With a near all-star cast, this movie about an unlikely World War II platoon tasked to rescue art masterpieces from Nazi thieves and return them to their owners hasn't made as much of a splash as I think it would have hoped to, but it does have a very clear message about the value of history, art, and human life. It also speaks about human legacy and what matters in the annals of time. We try to dissect where the film is a pointful and where it is just fun. And with a cast that included George Clooney, Matt Damon, Bill Murray, Cate Blanchett, John Goodman, John something I can't pronounce, Hugh Bonneville, Bob Balaban, and Dimitri Leonidas, it certainly has a little bit of both. So my guests this week are, to help me do this, are my wife, writer, blogger, and all-around wonderful person, Laura Fissell. Joining her, I am excited to have, from the Storymen podcast, Clay Morgan.
Hey, wait. You know, you just made it sound like you're excited to have me. My wife is here, but I'm excited.
Well, but I said she was an all-around wonderful person.
You did.
So, I mean, I can do it one more. Hold on. Okay. Let's try this again. My guest this week... are my wife, writer, blogger, and all-around wonderful person, Laura Fissell, joining her. I am also excited to have, but to a lesser extent, from the Storymen podcast, which I'm not married to and doesn't make me dinner on occasion and also tell me how I'm an idiot yet, Clay Morgan.
Well, thank you for that warm welcome.
You're welcome. Aren't we all welcome? Well, anyway... So like we do with everything, we'll start this with a very basic question just to get things started. Did you enjoy the film? And as always, if you're on Skype, you get to go first.
Oh, that would be me. Did I enjoy the film? An editor friend of mine, I think, summed it up best. And she said, I really wanted to love this movie. And as the, you know, history guy, so did I. Like, this was going to be, you know, Kelly's Heroes meets Ocean's 11.
That's right.
And it was not that or either of those things. I found myself really kind of falling back a little bit deeper into my seat as the movie went on, just kind of wondering what's going on. Why am I not, you know, engaging, and why am I not feeling anything until really I at the end of it, I just kind of walked away saying, boy, that was a mess. Like, I'm going to have to go back and reevaluate and think harder about what were the good parts rather than, you know, when you really like something, you got to go back and think, okay, where's the, where can I be more critical here?
Mm-hmm.
So that was my takeaway.
Laura?
Yeah, I feel that way.
Yes.
I really was excited about this movie.
She seriously was. Yeah. I think she made me promise that I was going to take her to it and that we would probably podcast on it like in not October, maybe September when I showed her like the first trailer.
Mm.
And to be honest, I was excited as well. I mean, that was about the time we were getting excited about it, right?
Yeah.
But with the heavy sigh.
Yes.
Well, I would say that I was pretty disappointed, but my disappointment was tempered because I realized when they moved this from December to February that
there was a problem.
I mean, for those people who don't know, typically, you know, you kind of push out everything in December as much as you can if you think it has a chance to win an award or whatever. And obviously someone looked at Monuments Men and said, look at all this other stuff that's coming out in December. And no.
Yeah.
And so I realized that it probably wasn't going to be like an award-winning, awesome thing. But I still had, I was like, look at this cast. I love John Goodman. You know?
I will say, I thought it was like beautiful and authentic.
Authentic.
I mean, the setting.
Yeah, I think they succeeded as filmmakers. And they did not succeed as storytellers.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
No, that makes perfect sense, which is, you know, lots of my critique about lots of things that I saw right at the end of last year. I was like, is this a story or do you just want to make really pretty pictures?
Yeah.
But that was a conversation I was about to have with JR, but that's another topic. So I feel like, Clay, a lot of what you just said kind of does wrap it up. I did find it humorous at time.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the humor, much like much of the critics said, kind of took me away from taking it too seriously. So when you have losses and stuff, and there is no spoiler warning on the show, we can talk about whatever. If we're going to talk about the narrative themes of a movie, we're going to talk about the whole movie. So, you mm-hmm. know, people die. Some of the monuments die. And I felt like I was supposed to feel something, but mm-hmm. I didn't.
Thank you. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. If there is a big sin of this movie, and again, I'll talk about some of the parts I really liked, but that's the feeling that came over me at one point. And I'm a person who really cares about art and culture's achievements. And I mean, I make my living.
I can
get really excited. And I guess in a way, I was even hoping I would get more excited about some of these. Mm-hmm. I remember at one point they kind of go show the burned out Picasso or whatever, and I felt nothing. And I was like, wow, how did you make this movie and manage to not even get me to care about the art, let alone the characters?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, by the end of it, I felt I wanted to care so much that I did kind of care about the statue. I feel like that has a very fancy name that I should have written down.
The Madonna of Bruges.
Yeah, the Bruges. Yes, the Bruges Madonna. I mean, I did care a little bit about that, and I knew that was kind of the goal, and that was obviously George Clooney, like Frank Stokes, his character's motivation. So I got that.
And they linked that Madonna to – it kind of became like the link to Donald's life. Like he made the sacrifice,
mm-hmm.
so it's like let's make this worth it, you know, that he died and we got this.
Well, I'll say, let me transition to this. We usually don't have a lot of questions, but one of our listeners, Rebecca, she actually posted that after watching the movie, she was kind of interested in hearing some of the things we had to say. And her comment was, well, actually I said, you know, what would you ask or what would you have us discuss or what would you love to hear people just talk about? She said the insane amounts of art that was taken and even the gold fillings, the true vision that led to forming the Monuments Men group, and the last part where he was asked if it was worth losing lives to save art. Also, the point that we can, as hard as it is, recover from losing a generation of men and women, but not from losing our history. You know, can't wait to hear it. So thanks, Rebecca, for actually asking questions. So I guess breaking that up, the most important question, did you come away from this film feeling that art is worth losing life for?
I felt like that last moment where the older Stokes is in the church with his grandson and, you know, says that line, like, yes, like, it was worth his life. I immediately thought the question, really? Was it really? Although I really did like that. I did like the moments where Donald was riding his dad, and I just liked that piece where he was inspired by the Madonna, that he saw something transcendent, that he was changed by it. But that was really the only thing I felt about the Madonna. I didn't feel like that was an example of how, well, I don't know, maybe that's it right there. Maybe that's why it's worth saving, is because it gives us a window into something that few other things do. But I definitely felt like I had to figure that out for myself. Like, it's not something that the movie told me to feel or to believe or to understand. I had to really work hard to know that.
You know, there's this scene, really a very cool scene, where they arrive and they hit Normandy Beach. And that is like a really iconic look at the shore. And they, you know, obviously D-Day has happened months in advance. And they have this like real poignant moment where they stand and look around. And for me, that kind of like put me in the moment better than almost any other scene. And Clooney actually is like talk narrating over that part right there. And when they hit the beach, he says something like, you know, remember, it's still a war zone. This is still dangerous. And no art is worth more than your life.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He makes that point, you know, because that's clearly a question that people were asking at the time. The military commanders they encounter don't want to be very helpful, feel that way. And, you know, again, it comes up at the end of the movie. But, you know, it was worth, at the same time, it's worth the risk to put this whole thing together for these guys. It's hard to know who they are, though. This is one of the problems with the movie. Like, the movie starts off and you throw six characters at us, you know, six main guys, and then you throw a couple, like a private at us, and then Cate Blanchett and a couple Germans. Like, I don't even know, outside halfway through figuring out that Matt Damon was the curator of the Met,
mm-hmm.
I don't even know who anybody else is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't develop anything. So it was like, well, how am I supposed to know? There's John Goodman standing on the beach. Like, there's John Goodman looking at a book. I didn't get lost in this convincing. I honestly couldn't even tell you, outside of Donald, who the other characters' names were. And that's really crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if – I guess anytime you have six plus characters you have to introduce into a movie, if Joss Whedon doesn't do it, you're probably not going to understand where these characters come from and how they fit into the story.
Yeah, there's a couple others.
No.
I put down when I was writing my notes, I wrote down, is this movie about camaraderie? Redemption. I put Jeffrey's name next to that. The value of art, the cost of war, the horrors enacted upon the Jews, what men will do for art, how art connects different people, because I kind of felt that way a little bit between Granger and Simone, I think was, Claire's character. So I felt like all of these things existed at one time, and they were touched on at different points. They were kind of lingered over with moments, but then they were rushed away from again. So you didn't really have any time to develop that or to feel moved by that. I mean, even the scenes where they were in these rooms full of Jewish artifacts that were like taken from people's homes, stolen from people's homes, and the teeth, like those were things that really should have been very
should take your breath away.
Yeah, you should have been horrified by it, but they just kind of just passed over these things. So I felt like that whole the whole question of what I felt like I thought the movie was going to be about, which is that, is art worth human life? Is art, does art have great value? I just felt like that was thrown into the mix. So I never felt like, in response to Rebecca's question, really, I never felt like I knew what they were trying to say about that or about any of these other things that I thought could be themes.
Well, at the end of the movie, to contrast the scene that Clay mentioned earlier on the beach, George Clooney's character also, you know, kind of ends some of the, I guess, speculation about it. And he says, they tell us who cares about art, but they're wrong. It's the exact reason we are fighting for culture, for a way of life. So it seems to answer a question that they didn't ask very well.
But, you know, go ahead. I was just going to say, you mentioned this, Laura, the tone. Like, what movie was George Clooney trying to make?
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the problem they continually ran into. Like, oh, we're going to be quirky and do our, you know, Leatherheads, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, like whatever thing, except, wait a second, the Holocaust is right next door. So,
yeah.
You know, there's only one Life is Beautiful. I don't know if you guys saw that one. Mm-hmm. You know, Roberto Benigni basically took a huge risk by deciding to do such a humorous film about the Holocaust. And because he pulled it off, he won the Oscar in, like, you know, 200 countries or whatever. But
mm-hmm.
I think there was just a real difficulty in you can't have the cheeky here comes the montage of all these middle-aged guys going into basic training and let's have the fun music, which isn't really fun at all. It's just kind of like doesn't work.
Yeah.
And then here's the teeth like you mentioned, and it takes Benigni like once in 40 years to pull that off. You know what I mean? Like
yeah.
And this just was not the right subject matter to be confused about tone, I think. So yeah, they end up losing the story because if you're going to make it about the art, you can't have so much of the presence of the reality of the horrors of human loss. Even though they were trying to make the point that because of the human loss, this matters. Mm-hmm. And it was just a real tough thing. So I sympathize with the challenge they had in making this film.
Well, so it goes back to the original question, and I know that we don't have a lot of confidence in the movie answering it in a thorough or even thoughtful way, but on your own.
Yeah. What is our answer?
Yeah. What is your answer? Is to save art or to save a piece of art I guess I can frame it this way. To me, I tried to wrestle with this question, is art worth life? And I was like, one piece of art? I don't think so. I'm probably not going to give up my life for a piece of art. Or at least I don't imagine myself doing that.
What about the Bible?
Of the Bible?
Yeah, and that's right. Because even like the one kind of obvious artifact, or if you go back to ancient Israelites, the Ark of the Covenant and these artifacts that might maybe mattered so much and actually had divine, you know, meaning. But like even if you're talking about the Bible and you could say, well, those are, you know, those are stories and those are words that people die for. But it's not like it's the only Bible in the world. Right. You know, millions have been destroyed and still millions more exist. So as you asked the question, I was thinking of like that first off, because if we're talking about creative work, certainly books count, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, but that's the contrast. So when I hear you say that, kind of hinted at, it's, there's lots of copies. Okay. So the thing that he eventually says is you can wipe out an entire generation. You can burn their homes to the ground and somehow they'll find a way to find their way back. But if you destroy their history, you destroy their achievements, then it's as if they never existed. Yeah. That's what Hitler wants, and that's exactly what we're fighting for. So if I'm not fighting for one Bible not to be destroyed, I can see myself being like, okay, whatever. But if someone's going to eradicate the Bible and its history from existence, I don't even know how someone would do that because it's so saturated into the entire world's culture. I guess if aliens came, was this like the Book of Eli now? Dystopian future. I have to memorize the whole thing and not die so I can tell it to some guy. Oh, spoiler alert. Book of Eli.
Whoops. That one slipped out.
Yeah.
I think then it's a question of what do you think that piece of art is? It's still about the human soul to me because if you're working, if you're risking your life to save something, some piece of art or some piece of literature, then it's still about what you, what good you think, well, at least me as a Christian, I guess, or my perspective, what that piece of art is going to do for other people. Like, how is it going to show, eternity, you know, how is it going to show truth? How is it going to show, the gospel? And I, you know, when I was thinking about this topic, I kept thinking about, Madeline L'Engle's book, Walking on Water, which I'm reading with a group of artists right now. And her position is that she says all art is cosmos found within chaos. At least all Christian art is cosmos and chaos. So for her, art is about bringing eternity, bringing heaven, bringing the cosmos, you know, into this world and showing us there's something beyond it, that there's something greater than us. So that being said, I could see risking life for a piece of art, but it would be in the context of what it could do for the human soul or human souls.
That's really interesting. You know who I was thinking about? Like, the one of the original monuments women was Dolly Madison. So she was the wife of President James Madison, and I don't know if you guys know the story, but in 1812 there was a war, and the British came all the way to D.C.
What was it called?
I think it was – I can never remember what that war was called in 1812.
History jokes.
Nerds. War of 1812. And the British – a lot of people don't realize. Like, the British came. Like, they invaded D.C. and they burned the White House to the ground. It was a dark day for the Capitol. But Dolly Madison, famously, her husband was away, actually the only sitting president to be out, like, leading some troops. And she knew that they were coming to get the White House. And she said, we have to save the portrait of Washington, the very famous portrait. Everybody's seen it, you know, if you don't ever know, you've seen it in your life. And, you know, like, the British are coming, and she's got these guys, you know, ripping the frame off the wall so she can save Washington's portrait. And the reason I thought that was such a perfect example was because not only was she saving art, but to her it was very personal, kind of to what you were just saying, Laura. And like, they knew Washington. You know, he had been dead over a decade at that point. He had been, like, you know, their leader. And I was thinking that art is obvious because it has so much of a platform. It's so culturally significant. But if you ever know somebody whose hard drive crashed and they lost their book they were writing, or if you ever know somebody whose house burned and they lost all of their family photos, it's devastating to lose these artifacts, or, you know, artwork that the kids made in elementary school. It's devastating because the things that we create, they carry a part of us, right? Mm-hmm. And they're these ever delicate links to a past that we know is never coming back. So to see any artifact lost, the more personal it is, the more of an impact that has. And in a way, the great works of the masters, they're personal to all of us because we all grow up learning about Da Vinci, learning about Picasso and the Mona Lisa. And so it's that connection to something we share and to the past that makes it sting. Now the question is, do we really lose that? You know, because if we lose the piece of art, most people who think the Mona Lisa is amazing have never actually seen the Mona Lisa. Mm-hmm. You know, we can still talk about it and tell about it for a long time, but there is this pain of losing that link to the past. And like you said, it's very personal. It's somebody's, it's like It's like they put part of their creative force, part of their life force into that. And it feels like that they are going to die in a way anew when that item is destroyed or lost.
Yeah, but at the same time, does it really matter? Or are there two different worldviews fighting each other right now? Because on the one hand, if I don't have a worldview that has a picture of eternity, then I am clinging to my past. I'm clinging to my heritage, where I came from, who it's going to make me to be, the legacy that I leave here on Earth to a certain degree in probably tangible objects as opposed to souls affected or anything like that. But if I have a worldview where I think, you know, souls go on forever and stuff is just stuff, and ultimately the only thing that really matters is the creator of the universe, then do I care if everything Picasso ever made was destroyed?
Well, that's what I was saying about whatever, it's whatever you believe about the impact of that piece of art. Because if you think that, if you do believe that the soul is eternal and that, you know, we're commissioned to like save his, like God, he desires that nobody should perish. And so we're commissioned on this planet to try to spread the gospel to as many souls as possible. So if you think that that Picasso is like a way that, you know what I'm saying? I guess it depends on what you believe is the impact of that sure. particular piece of art.
Or does it convey a message that can't be conveyed in some other way? Maybe? Nope. Okay, just picking.
Well, I mean, it's whatever you believe about it, I guess. Maybe some people would believe that about Picasso.
We had this guy on the Storyman podcast named Randall Rouser. He's a theologian from Canada, and we were talking about heaven. And he was talking about this whole field of theology where people ponder whether or not part of the recreation of the new earth and like what heaven really is would actually include the restoration of a lot of the great cultural achievements and creations. This was a few months ago. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, like would the Titanic be a physical thing or, you know, some of these other things. And it was a really interesting conversation, but it really brings you back to the whole fundamental idea of human existence, that we are creation, right? Like that God has this love for, you know, speaking these beautiful pictures, these nebulas, the universe. He creates these unique artistic things, and that's imprinted on us. You know, we bear his image, and so we are works of art. You know, I think it's Ephesians that talks about us being his workmanship, or I think the word in Greek means masterpieces. And that idea that we are made to be creative, and you know, for those of us who pursue creative things on a regular basis, we think about this more probably. But creation, it is art to me. And so just as we are a piece of God and his imprint is upon us, we put our imprint upon those things. And that's why, you know, art is worship. You know, music, the composers that were rebelling against the hyper-rationalism of the Enlightenment, the painters like Turner who just couldn't take it anymore. They didn't need to have a formula to explain why the explosive sunrise was so powerful. And Handel just said, I don't care if I have, you know, a science equation. Here's Messiah. Like, I dare you to listen to this and not get out of your seat because, you know, art is worship. So it definitely gets to the heart. And if someone like Picasso, for example, or, you know, I don't know, Van Gogh or someone is creating things just for different reasons, it still is art. And I believe that we inject the meaning into it ourselves. You know, that's why anybody who says a story or a piece of art is about something, they're right. Even if the artist would say, no, that's not it at all, they're still right because they found that meaning. And if you find it in a way that brings, you know, a new picture or feeling about God, I think that is very powerful.
Yeah. And as you talk about like the Messiah, for example, that just makes me think about how, you know, if we protect a painting that none of us have done, somebody else did, you know, or a piece of music like that, that we weren't a part of, but we're really protecting someone's experience of God that they're communicating to us and giving us a bigger picture of him and his character and the eternal. And that, I think, maybe is, I see that in how the Monuments Men in this movie were protecting the Madonna. We're really passionate about finding the Madonna because Jeffries had a transcendent experience. Yeah. You know, if you go back to that quote, that all art is cosmos out of the chaos, there was total chaos going on, war, fear. And Jeffries, in that church, sitting in front of the Madonna, glimpsed the cosmos in the midst of that. And, you know, it provided for him a space of clarity, of calm. He was able to kind of reflect on his life, apologize to his father. So I think.
Didn't he say?
That is what they were trying, you know, his friends were trying to do, is not just protect the Madonna, but protect it because it represented, I don't know, a moment with God that they didn't necessarily experience personally, but touched them through someone's experience. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking when that scene you're talking about, remember he asked for help or something and the commander said, that's an interesting job you have there, but no, we can't help or something. And he said something like, this piece is somehow, it's like really unique to the Catholic Church. It was somehow a really powerful specific piece. Not, I don't know if it was the Madonna. There was like an altarpiece or something, or was that it? Was that the Madonna? He was saying something about this is like irreplaceable to the entire Catholic faith. And
yeah, I thought that was the
Ghent altarpiece.
Yeah, the Ghent altarpiece.
Okay, that's it. So they were wise, I think, then to if they did try to do one thing right, you know, it was to kind of highlight one piece that we could at least to focus on something, you know, That definitely had that religious significance.
Well, something else that you were saying earlier, Clay, was that when you think about art and arts and creation, we create art. I believe, at least Laura and I believe, that we create art because we're imprinted with the fingerprints of the creator, who is an artist himself. But saying that almost betrays where I was going with it, because if we're his art, then is God's art more important than our art? I mean, like, is human life more important than saving a piece of art, no matter how impactful it is?
I don't know. As an artist, I feel like my art is God's art. I feel like there have been many times in my writing when I haven't intentionally been writing a passage, but it comes out because I feel like I'm working in tandem with something larger than myself.
But that's what those forums you go to about like letters to publishers and stuff, they're like, God gave me this word. You must publish it.
Oh yeah.
This is really God's art. You should sell way more.
Yeah.
Books.
Well, there's certainly delusion for room for delusion too. I know a lot of agents hear that in the Christian market, like, oh, you have to represent me because God told me you had to. And
I swear you didn't tell me.
Yeah. Right. I actually wasn't on the other end. No, life, human life is the absolute highest of the highest value. And love is the highest ideal on earth. So no, there is no matter what is at stake, no matter what is about to burn, or you know, think of like whatever it is, the most precious possible artifact in your own, you know, worldview, whatever that is it worth allowing, you know, someone you love to run in and die trying to save it? No, because, you know, what meaning is lost if you lose that person, in, you know, before we talk about losing the art? And that's why, you know, those guys are going in after the areas are cleared for the most part and things like that. But yeah, life certainly matters most, and it's an important story to be told. I just think it's really tough. They had to brush up against those Holocaust stories, you know, and it just made it a bit of an ADD-ish story.
Most definitely. So what was that?
What were your favorite parts? There were a couple scenes I really liked. kind of like standalones. Did you guys?
Let's bring it back.
Did you guys have any of those?
I did. Do you want to go into them, Mike?
Well, we have a format here on this show.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't want to bust it up.
And suddenly Clay thinks he's in charge of the podcast, not the guest. But actually,
I thought we skipped it. I forgot to say something nice.
Actually, my favorite moment really ties in with what we were just saying about human life being the ultimate. Well, okay, even as I say that, I'm not sure I believe that human life is the ultimate thing of value. Maybe the human soul is. But my favorite moment was when Granger returned this portrait of a woman to an empty apartment. It belonged to some Jews that ended up in this warehouse or whatever, and he somehow found the address, and he returned it to the apartment and hung it on the wall where it clearly used to go. And it wasn't even, you know, the whole movie, it's about the great artist, the great artwork that we recognize, but this was not a great piece of art, but I think it represented a life to me, that that what we're really talking about is human life, human existence. So I felt pretty touched by that moment, if by any moment in the movie, that it was still important. This art piece was still important because it represented, something bigger. It represented this family or this woman.
Okay. I don't want to like totally. Well, I guess I just don't see eye to eye with how you saw that scene, which is a beautiful thing about movies, because I remember watching that.
It's okay, you're wrong.
I know. we're all aware of this. When I saw that scene, I was like, is he doing this because he cares or because he's trying to show Claire that he really wants to return the art? Like, maybe it was because, like we've already mentioned, we're really disconnected from the movie. Mm-hmm. So I don't really feel Matt Damon's James Granger. I don't really feel his passion about returning art.
I think I would have felt that way, except he didn't know that Simone was going to follow him.
Oh, he knew.
Okay.
Matt Damon knows.
Okay.
That's kind of why she annoyed me. I got the sense
that he was doing it because he was almost reminding himself why he was there, what he was doing, the whole why he was part of the Monuments Men, and that it was for him and not for her. But because it was such a real moment for him, I think that's why. I mean, clearly, Simone was not a stupid woman. You know,
she's a little lonely.
Apparently. I think she probably could have discerned if she was being manipulated by that. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, Clay.
Well, she lost me when she was like, I'm not going to help you because you're probably just going to steal it too. Like, I care about this art so much, except I'd rather see it destroyed than possibly work with some. I'm like, really? Like,
you just work with the Nazis.
Yeah.
In the speech.
Wouldn't you rather see it survive and be in America, even if that's what he was doing?
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. Apparently, French people really hate Americans more so than they hate Nazis. At least Hitler was just going to take it to some museum. The Americans will probably sell it and use it for toilet paper.
Yeah, right.
I explicitly got that. I just, like I said, it was hard to get behind any particular character, even when they did have pseudo-touching moments, because I didn't understand why they were having touching moments. Because, you know, we typically do like the come on moment, like the thing that doesn't make the most sense. And then we follow it with our favorite. And when I was thinking back to putting something in each of these categories, I actually came up with the same moment and it fit both categories. Because it was when they played like the Christmas record for Bill Murray's character. I was like, I can imagine this being in someone's mind and this being an exceptionally sweet scene and really heartfelt, and I was kind of enjoying it, and then I realized it didn't matter because I don't know who this character was. I didn't really know who was singing. I didn't really feel like he was in a lot of danger necessarily, or that he had really talked about how much he missed home. So I was like, I love this scene for no point that it makes. Hmm. So.
Yeah, the reason that question popped in my head about what your favorite scenes were is, you know, we're talking about the meaning of life and the value of life. And I was thinking of that scene where Clooney squares off against the Nazi commander or whatever, and they sit across the table and neither one of them smokes except Clooney does. And, you know, he's like, I'm going to go home and I'm going to be down at the deli, down at, you know, Saul Melman's deli or whoever. And I'm going to read the paper one day and it's going to say that you've been killed. And it's like a satisfying thing on a visceral level, but it's like, you know, it just, again, it kind of pollutes the value of human life. Like, yes, we all want justice and everything, but it's just like a weird scene. Like, it got really intense, and it's like, life matters, except you're going to be super happy when yours ends tragically and horribly. I just had that down. It was one of the most compelling scenes. I don't know if it was a favorite scene, but that was kind of striking to me.
Well, I think it felt like he had watched, that Quentin Tarantino movie.
Inglourious Basterds?
Yeah, Inglourious Basterds. And was like, you know, when you sit face to face with a Nazi, it makes a really compelling scene. And I was like, no. You're George Clooney. That was Quentin Tarantino. Doesn't work the same way. Also, Nazi wasn't played by Christoph Waltz. If it was, I'd have been really into that scene.
Yeah, no kidding. That guy's amazing.
I'll almost basically go see anything because he's in it right now.
Yep.
Stay on target.
Whatever, tangent. Other than that, I mean, I really did kind of feel like you described at the beginning. I had to really sit back and think of a lot of my more favorite moments than I had to convince myself I liked the movie. And like I said, I did enjoy it. I wouldn't necessarily mind watching it again, but not because of any of the points I think they made the film. Most of my favorite moments were comedic moments between John Goodman or Bill Murray.
The barn, where they sat down in the barn. That was a good scene.
Yeah.
Some of the writing's just so bad, though. I mean, like, Stahl is escaping, which I don't know why that's like cloak and dagger. He's got all the power. Why is he worried about sneaking off? And she's just like, I see you. I see you. I see you. I'm like, this is Kate Blanchett. Like, that's the best you can do. And they threw in like a joke there. Like, they literally had one of the guys tell Bill Murray, like, oh, I didn't think you could read. Like, that's the best dig. Like, it was just like, you know, they must have mailed in some of it.
I was trying to find somewhere where, I could find snippets of Jeffrey's letter, because I was trying to remember what he said to his father, which it just made me feel sad that I couldn't remember anything that he said in that touching moment, because apparently it wasn't really that touching or memorable. And all the quotes that people are pulling out of this to be a part of like quote galleries are awful. It just made me, it just was like highlighting to me how horrible the script was. It was like, let's have lunch. Oh, is it on you? No, it's on Uncle Sam. I'm like, really? That's the quote from the movie?
Yeah.
Anyone else imagine like George Clooney, like in a dark room with just a little lamp and a piece of he's like, he starts chuckling to himself. Oh, they're going to love this one. It's on Uncle Sam.
Him and Grant Heslov. This is awesome. Although, Mikey, you sent the link to Zeke Film, the review there. And he opens up talking about like Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. And he was like, this movie is as good as Last Crusade. And I was like, oh my goodness. Like, he either way misjudged this or he's burning the Last Crusade. Like, this movie, Indiana Jones is one of the greatest characters in the history of cinema. And you're going to compare it to, I can't even call him anything but George Clooney's character. George Clooney's. I couldn't believe that comparison was made.
No, yeah. And see, that's the thing about some of the stuff I find. And it actually made me a little hesitant about end up going through with this podcast in the first place. I wanted to talk about the value of art and that versus the value of life like so much that I went with a lot less base material than we usually have. So you've actually done a very good job because you found a lot more, you found a silver lining on a movie that actually I don't think I've podcasted on a movie that I haven't really enjoyed yet. I think I've really enjoyed almost everything. This is probably like my least favorite.
Despicable Me too.
It was okay.
You were really disappointed by that one.
I was pretty disappointed. That was, I think that's a case of exceptionally high expectations.
Yeah, and that's partially what's going on here. It's funny you say that. You know, I was doing I do a classic movie thing with a friend, and we like went for a long time, and then finally I saw a movie that I just didn't like at all, and I was like, oh, it's going to be weird. Like, we always just are so happy about these things. But Laura, I think, what did you compare this movie to? Did you really put it up on the podium with Titanic and Pearl Harbor?
I didn't mention Titanic, but I did say Pearl Harbor.
Well, Titanic gets the gold, right? So maybe for me. So if Pearl Harbor is one of the most disappointing worst history movies ever, like I hadn't even thought of that yet because it's so new. Is it too soon? But yeah, like you could almost start to have the conversation. And one thing I say as a history teacher is this, to your point, Mikey, at least, first of all, there's a really great conversation to be had about art and human life. But at least when these movies come out, even if they aren't done so well, it was done very, it was done by professionals, and it at least gets people aware of history. Mm-hmm. You know, it at least gets people to know, you know, where France is and Belgium is a thing, and that there was a
Belgium is a thing.
You know, coming a week after, you know, the study shows that 1 in 4 Americans aren't aware that the Earth rotates around the sun. Mm-hmm. I'm happy if any movie comes out that helps reinforce history. Mm-hmm.
But
even if it is some of the most terrible storytelling,
that's what I'm saying. Can you really look back and say Pearl Harbor taught anybody anything about history?
Okay, yeah.
Except for there was a black guy that shot down a plane, and apparently it was Cuba Gooding Jr.
I'm sorry. Was there a movie on? All I heard was Kate Beckinsale. It can be tough.
I did find myself researching how much of this was true and reading the true story behind
That's right. So they saved $5 million. Good. They were originally commissioned to go in and save churches and historic buildings, and they ended up figuring out like, hey, we might as well save all this, the internal artifacts while we're at it. And they saved mm-hmm. 5 million pieces, monuments, men and women. So there's some good stuff in there.
Oh, actually, no. That was one of the coolest things. When they stopped trying to tell a story and they just showed me what happened, they would show the pictures. It's like, this is what this town looked like. And, like, the only thing standing somehow was, like, this one building.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, that's pretty amazing that this one building somehow survived.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is why I watch the History Channel all the time. This is why I was a history major. I hope it's probably why you're a history professor. I mean, I really like that episode of the Story Men you guys had where you talked about the things that need to be made into a movie.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was like, people, if you just read history books, there's great stories there. And I was very lucky because all of my favorite history professors when I grew up, they didn't just tell me the facts. They told me stories,
mm-hmm.
Which leads me back to the power of story, which the podcast is about. And the Story Men kind of like story as well, I guess.
Yeah, we're kind of into it. I'll tell you, man, I teach classes that are anywhere in length from 1 hour to, like, I literally teach all day Saturday sessions. And, you know, you read a room pretty well after a few years. And when people are fading and I just don't know where to go next, I just, you know, start telling a story, forget the PowerPoint or whatever. And it's amazing how story in a history class, political science class, it'll just kind of bring people to life. And even though this one was disappointing, it still does tell a story. It just doesn't tell it very well. And so you can at least follow it to the end and then like, yay, they find the Madonna. It's exciting.
Yeah. I mean, and hopefully, cause it did, I didn't even realize this happened. And I love World War II history. And So I much like Laura, was like, hey, let me go figure out what happened. Are these guys really real? How much of it's real? Which was most of the links I originally sent out, because I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to just know. I like the fact that they've tried to make a movie very similar to this before in The Train, which is why, yeah, I linked that. It probably was...
Burt Lancaster.
Yep. Burt Lancaster was probably keeping it historically accurate.
John Frankenheimer. Mr. Manchurian Candidate.
You know, so... When I look at... Compared to other war movies, I remember seeing lots of... Hey, Monuments Men's getting ready to come out. We're going to do like a top 10 list of best war movies ever in preparation for it. I remember seeing a whole bunch of good movies, and some of them tell okay stories, but they're not necessarily true. You know, it's like one of my favorite movies ever is Saving Private Ryan, and yeah, the actual story's not true. It's compelling, and it teaches me a lot about what was going on, and it makes me interested in it.
Same with Kelly's Heroes. I mean, I think for this kind of – when I think George Clooney in Ocean's 11,
mm-hmm,
you know, and what was the key to Kelly's Hero? The characters were more well-defined, but there was one object, right? There was one heist. And someone said it rightly so. If this movie would have had, you know, that one kind of signature item, and then there was like, we pan back to see, oh, look at all the other stuff they saved. It would have been easier to get behind, like, here's one plan to get one item. But they were trying to also show the scope of it, so it wasn't Kelly's Heroes.
What do you do?
What do you do?
Well, hopefully, like I said, ultimately just get people interested. You know, get people talking. Make more history majors.
That's right.
It's what my history teacher in college told me. He said, do you know why I come in here every day and tell people about things they don't care about? And I said, I don't know, you get paid? Yeah, because I was kind of a smart
something. Alec.
I was a smart Alec. he goes, to turn people into history majors. And I was like, dang it.
So they too can have a degree they will not be able to get a job with. Yeah, so they can have a
degree that...
History vandalism.
Yeah. Well...
I'm not great at remembering historical facts.
You are, if someone puts it in a story.
Yeah. But the more and more I taught English and literature, the more I, my kids would start to complain that they would complain like that I was treating it like a history class, but I just didn't know how else to talk about a piece of literature if you didn't know the context of the literature or the culture around when it was written or the audience that the person was writing to. And so I would just do a lot of historical background before we even read.
Yeah. And that's it too. Like on day one, I walk in and I'm usually like, okay, how many of you hate history? And, you know, see how many hands go up. And, you know, they all have the same reasons they don't like history, because it was boring or because it was pointless. You know, somebody made them memorize a list of names and dates. And I tell them on day one, like, that's not history, that's memorization. And really, it's about the context, and it's about understanding the deeper meaning. You know, history, the study of history has value far beyond the field of history. It's every single person in the world loves history. They might only love their personal history, they might love their family's history, but eventually all of those things are connected to the larger history. And, you know, you can kind of like leave the breadcrumbs and lead people to find out like, oh, this really does matter to me. And I really do care about this. And I really am asking big questions. So Monuments Men does a great job in leading us to some of these.
Well, that's very true. And I think if people realize that, they would realize that everyone does connect on that level. Because we talked at the beginning, we're all Steelers fans. I'm very connected to the history of the Steelers organization.
There we go, Steelers.
Yeah, that's right. I got Sixburg.
Yes. So,
you know, I'm excited about that. But then other people try to use history against you. You know, what have you done for me lately?
For sure.
But like I said, it's amazing how much you can convey history-wise if you turn it into a story and you don't just let it be an item, which is one of the things that I really liked about Jesus. See how that full circle? Well, I mean, because he literally could have come in and said, hey, you guys know what they said in the Old Testament, right? You know, just keep doing that, right?
Yeah.
There's like a list. You just memorize the list, keep doing it. Everyone good, right? It just didn't work that way because people weren't wired that way.
Yeah.
God, I mean, we believe that God's a storyteller. And so why would we not want to tell? So why would we not connect?
It's his story, Mikey.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, he embodied history. He broke history in half.
Oh, man. Well, I don't know where to go from there.
Drop the mic.
Yeah. Someone get some Michael W. Smith on. Yeah, yeah.
So, in a list of things that I hope would never get mentioned on this podcast, Michael W. Smith.
Hey, I'm down with MW.
You don't need to. Oh gosh.
This is an all skate. We need to get a little Amy Grant, Michael W. Smith on, and everybody grab your partner at the skating rink.
Whoa, I mean, careful how you grab it. We need to leave a little room for the Holy Spirit.
6 inches for the Holy Spirit. I used to tell my Young Life kids, no purple, right? Boys are blue, girls are pink, no purple.
No purple.
How did we get there? I'm sorry. My ADD kicked in.
We got there because we moderately were entertained by this movie. And right. It did make us think of a whole bunch of things that were worth talking about. But it kind of did it in a wacky way, which now I feel bad because the first person who's ever asked us to ask questions
like
on
the
show, you know, like the movie. And I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I think it's worth discussing or we wouldn't have podcasted on it.
Yes.
But I think the only movie I've seen so far this year that I liked more leaster. I'm a history major. RoboCop.
How about less?
No. RoboCop was worse than this.
Okay. I didn't see it, so. There's something, George Clooney.
That's right. You are better than Joel Kinnaman.
Monuments Men, because it's not as bad as RoboCop.
That's right. When you go to the theater this weekend. Hold on. When you go to the theater this weekend, just remember, it's not RoboCop.
Hey, I didn't think it was that bad.
Oh.
It actually shared some similar problems in storytelling, didn't it?
It did.
Interesting.
But that's neither here nor there. So is there any other ridiculous moments you want to point out or favorite moments that you want to hit on, Clay?
From the movie or from this podcast? I was thinking, you know, they have the Razzies for the worst movies. Your guy's version could be the Fizzies.
The Fizzies. Wait, see, I already have a lot of connotation with my last name because it was like, oh, I guess it just fizzled out. And I'm like, oh, man, you got jokes. You got jokes.
Yeah, I got jokes like, I didn't know you could read.
I didn't know you could read.
No, that's all I got on Monuments Men, I think.
Laura?
Not necessarily. That hasn't been talked about. My come on moment was the scene where Granger stepped on the mine. Like, it almost could have been a good scene, a funny scene, but it just basically, for me, embodies the tonal confusion of the script. Because it's like, oh, is this funny? Or, I mean, he could be blown to bits.
Yeah.
He's not worried at all. And. Right. I mean, he's like, oh, this is bad, but I'm not, like, going to freak out or anything. And they're like, well, we're going to stay right here because that's totally what would have happened.
Exactly.
Well, it confusingly told me they were all in it together.
Hmm.
You know?
The whole movie starts. As soon as they split up, they lost something. Like, first of all, I don't even know who's where. I don't know what they're doing. You know, so that whole idea that they split the team up was problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're back together and we've seen them together for like, you know, 3 minutes of screen time and now they're ready to die together.
Yeah.
So if they split up, who's Fred and Daphne and who's like Shaggy and Scooby?
Well, clearly Matt Damon is always Fred.
Let's see. Nope. That's all I had.
I mean, I definitely did like Epstein's story, and I was reading about how he's one of the last, maybe one of the last living monument, last surviving Monument Men. His real name is Harry Ettlinger, but I mean, the way that they had, they wrote Epstein's character was pretty accurate, and I mean, I thought it was fairly powerful when he had a private viewing of this Rembrandt that he was never allowed to see with his grandfather.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And I also read that Ettlinger, the real guy, he actually has a print of that Rembrandt self-portrait in his house. Mm. So I liked that moment pretty well.
Because you read the history on it?
Yep.
Yeah, and you know, that's it. Like, a lot of people will like, cops will always criticize cop dramas. Doctors will always criticize medical dramas. And Christians will always criticize Noah. But, you know, a lot of history teachers will criticize any history film. And I don't ever want to do that, because there is an art to telling a story in a different way. You know, the reason I typically, you know, make fun of these two or three history movies we mentioned is because it failed in storytelling. So if you want to take license, if you want to jazz it up, like, by all means, you know, do it. I would love to see a couple more American Revolution flicks, you know, regardless of how historically perfectly accurate it was. So there are great stories that the one you just mentioned there, I saw a couple of profiles as well. And, you know, there's living people who were part of this. They'll tell you that's not exactly how it happened, but they're still excited to see the story told.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that in and of itself is the entire reason that it's unfortunate that it doesn't technically count as a movie, but Band of Brothers is one of my favorite things ever.
Yeah.
Ever. Oh, yeah. One of the most amazing things ever put on film.
Yeah.
How did you feel about Pacific then?
Interestingly, Pacific, I struggled with it initially for some of the same reasons I struggled with Monuments Men. I could not figure out in Pacific who the characters were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in a way, it was shot in that choppy live action battle mode. I couldn't be invested because I couldn't even tell what I was looking at and who I was looking at. Mm-hmm. And by the time I got to the end of Pacific, and you know how they kind of have that pattern where they reveal who the real people were, and I watched all the extras, I watched all of the interviews with the real guys. You know, then I'm like weeping and I want to go right back through and watch it because now I know who everybody is.
Yeah, but have you gone back through and watched it?
I didn't. I went back and watched like pretty much all the extras I could find online, but I didn't go back and watch it again.
Yeah.
But that's not so much a judgment on it. I mean, I really do think it was amazing. I also like own Band of Brothers on Blu-ray and I've never watched it. Like I have to be like prepared and ready to go on that journey again, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like we have a little bit of free time and it's like, oh, you want to watch an episode of Band of Brothers? No, because no. I want to watch every episode mm-hmm. of Band of Brothers.
Right. Like I need to wait till I get the flu and I'm going to like just sweat out and weep for a weekend. And that's how I'm going to do it again.
Well, and the other problem is like, which one would I choose?
Cause right. You can't.
You're like, oh, I'll just choose my favorite, which is all of them.
I know. It's so good.
Well, I sort of agree with that sentiment, but if I'm going to watch one episode of Band of Brothers, it's going to be when Spears runs across that field.
Spears. I did this feature on my old blog called Hollywood Existential, Moments of Characters in Crisis, whether they're funny or serious or whatever. And the very first Hollywood Existential ever was Spears talking to the young guy, basically saying, you're just not ready to die. You'll stop being afraid as soon as you're ready to die. Spears is crazy good.
He is. Oh, gosh. Anyway. Well.
So there you go, Monuments Men. Band of Brothers next time.
Yeah. Be filmed with most of the color taken out. Don't have wonky music. And have Tom Hanks in it.
Monuments 2, The Voyage Home.
What happened to the real story of the cargo ship and returning the art? Oh, gosh. All right. Well, this is the beautiful time in the show where my guests who put up with me for a little over an hour get to tell you where they can be found.
So, the Clay? Easiest place right now is so we are in the process of got some big things coming in just a couple of weeks. So if you follow me on Twitter at ClayMorganPA or Facebook.com at ClayMorganPA, or best of all, our podcast, The Story Men. So you can go to facebook.com/The Story Men. Right now, social media is the best place to find me, and you'll know when we launch our big, new, exciting projects in just a couple of weeks.
Mm. And you're talking about The Story Men, right?
No, I'm talking about something that hasn't been announced yet.
Oh. Did you write another book?
Yeah, I'm working on a couple. but yeah, you can also go pick up Undead, Revived, Resuscitated, Reborn if you want to read about zombies and Jesus and God and meaning.
Well, as an aside to your promotion, how does The Story Men work? Because I found out about you guys through the podcast initiative, this group that we're all on Facebook.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as I found out about you guys, you were like, eh, we're done with season two. And we'll record more when we feel like it.
So we took an extended hiatus in between season two and three because of all of the new things we're launching.
Okay.
We're all writers and speakers. And Matt Michelatis, who's written a couple books, Imaginary Jesus and different other books, he speaks a lot through the holidays. JR has tons of responsibilities, and I ended up with the busiest teaching semester of my life. So we took an extra few weeks to get these new projects going, and we're ready to come back with a bang. So it typically isn't a 3-month break.
Okay. I've been meaning to ask. I just got lazy.
I've been meaning to tell.
I can tell. So, Laura, how can people follow your work?
Well, before I say that, I have a closing thought about Monuments Men.
Laura, do you have any closing thoughts about Monuments Men?
Nice.
I think from the whole experience, at least it made me consider, like what we were talking about, like the value of art. And so just in my reflection about tonight, I wrote... this movie might seem to say that art is important because it's all the beauty we can have here. It is us leaving our mark, the signpost that says we're here and we're worth something. But the greater, more lasting perspective seems to me that art brings hope into the soul because it is a picture that there is something beyond this life. So I appreciate the fact that this movie caused me to reflect on that greater truth. I'm a writer, and... I don't really write anything that people can read. I'm trying to sell my novel, young adult fiction. But I do write weekly on my blog, leavingteaching.wordpress.com.
Uh-huh.
And I pretty much use Twitter a lot.
If I would want to see this lot of twittering, what name would I follow?
I don't know if I can remember my name.
It's just like Laura underscore Fizzle.
I think it's Laura underscore Fizzle.
It is Laura underscore Fizzle.
And, yeah.
You know I'm following those tweets, girl.
I tweet whenever I post a new blog post, or sometimes if I'm, like, in the middle of a project, I like to tweet about my work and et cetera. So...
Cool.
And I write Doctor Who episode
reviews
on Real World Theology.
That's right, she does.
But guess who just followed you? This guy.
Yes.
Who's got two thumbs and just followed you on Twitter?
I wasn't going to go two thumbs. Looks like we got some physification.
Uh-oh. Mm-hmm. We do. But you're... Spoiler alert, man.
I'm snaking it, man.
Well, if you missed any of that because of the eclectic nature of the end of this podcast, then I will have all the ways to contact Clay, all the ways to get up with him, all the ways to contact Laura in the show notes. And if you want to interact with me or let me know of movies you'd love to hear us discuss on the show, then feel free to follow me on Real World Theology Twitter, which is @RealWorldTheo, or follow me on the aforementioned @Fizzification. You can also find us on our blog, realworldtheology.com. That's Real World, R-E-E-L. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you do find us on iTunes, review the show, bump our rankings, and let's get more people involved in the conversation. Again, I just want to thank my guests for being here. Thank you.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Laura. And you, the listeners, for taking time to make us part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless.